Okay, Darren, you can have a go.
Hi, good evening and good morning and good day to whoever's listening or whoever, sorry, will be listening. And hi to everyone tonight. Frank, hi. Faith, JL, welcome. I'm going to try and get through this without too many mistakes or anything. So tonight we are discussing chapter 10 of Tragedy and Hope, and it's called The Social and Constitutional Background Relating to Britain, the Background to the Appeasement from 1900 to 1939. It goes through the nature of the political system of the UK preceding World War II, the attitudes of the people that were manning the post, as it were, in all these various political institutions. It takes you through what Carol Quigley mentions in the very first sentence in this chapter. He mentions that, I'll just read it, in the course of the 20th century, Britain experienced a revolution as profound and considerably more constructive than those in Russia or Germany. The magnitude of this revolution cannot be judged by the average American, because Britain has been, to most Americans, one of the less familiar countries of Europe. And then he goes on to compare the United States to the UK in many ways, but one of the ways that he gets to straight up front is the fact that the United Kingdom, as opposed to America, does not have a formal constitution written down into a legal code or anything, whereas the United States does have a constitution that is very broad and basically protects everyone from each other, or at least it should. I think it's really only the Americans that have such a written legal document. I don't know if any other country in the world has got quite the same thing as the United States. Many countries do have a constitution, but the American one it's the most complete, and it seems to be the one that is the most defended, and the people of the country still seem to have they safeguard that constitution. It still seems to come up in the average American's mind that that they have a constitutional right to this and that, and that they ought to protect that right. And I imagine that people are in more modern times a little bit less worried about it and have perhaps forgotten how important the Constitution is. I know that in South Africa during 2020, I had to say to people, look, we are a constitutional republic here in South Africa. The things that you're seeing happening around you are, you know, no one's allowed to overstep certain rights and protections that you have. So become familiar with the Constitution as quickly as you can, or otherwise you're going to end up following dictates you won't even think of holding anyone to account for overreaching your rights as they are written down in a formal constitution. In comparison, the UK, they have what they would maybe term an unwritten constitution, and a constitution that is based upon traditional conventions, but quickly goes on to just let people know that neither of those two things are true. The fact that the UK's so-called constitution is basically based on statute and legal code, it's law. And if you look up the word statute, it's a decree from normally the edict of a ruler, and it falls under positive law. In other words, it's prohibitory. It tells you what you can't do. And the intention behind a statute is that it's permanent. It's meant to be permanent. So residents of the United Kingdom live under law, under a set of statutes. As we'll see, they very much rely on the aristocracy, the people in power. They very much rely on them to be decent, because when it comes to defending what they hold as their rights, or to push back in some way using the legal system, you'll see that most of the English public have never really had true access to justice, to the justice legal system as equals. In the UK, there's very much been, as Quigley says, a two-class system. You have the somebodies, and you have the its, the nobodies in a sense. You have the classes, and you have the masses. So that's the, let's see. He goes on to mention that the British cabinet, which is dominated by the inner clique of the political party that happens to be in power, it dictates down to the other compartments or chambers of government. The Commons essentially is just the platform that the cabinet through the that the party through the cabinet and down, they use the Commons really just to voice their edicts to Parliament. To if they are willing to grace the opposition with the chance to oppose, then they may allow it. But essentially, what happens with the cabinet is that they have, the cabinet, due to the old social order, which we'll mention shortly, you could say it's saturated from the top down in all the various chambers of government with the right people, the somebodies, the elite. In a sense, even if a minority party had to come in, it wouldn't really matter, because the people in the institutions are essentially of one mind, of one body, and they've all been to the same schools, and they've got the same social attitudes. See here, so the cabinet of the UK had its start 380 years ago. It's a decision-making body. The members appointed by the Prime Minister, chosen from members of Parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And quickly then goes on to explain the history of the political parties from the turn of the 20th century up until the Second World War. So I just made a note. It says the cabinet rules the roost, top down, central, unanswerable to the public, historically controlled by the Conservatives. In the United States, the political parties are very decentralized, with all power flowing from the local districts inward to the central committee. Any man who wins the party nomination in a local primary and in the election can become a party leader. In Britain, the situation is entirely different. The party control is almost completely centralized in the hands of a largely self-perpetuating inner clique. And this clique, because of the lack of primary elections, has power of approval over all candidates and can control party discipline by its ability to give the better constituencies to the more docile party members. So the traditional conventions are in play, in a sense. He goes on to talk about some of these party conventions that occur in government. And he makes a note. He says another convention, generally stated in most emphatic terms, is concerned with the impartiality of the Speaker of the House of Commons. The validity of this convention can be judged by reading Hansard for 1939 and observing the way in which the Speaker protected the members of the government from adverse questioning. Such questioning of members of the government by the opposition in Parliament has frequently been pointed out as one of the guarantees of free government in Britain. So he then points out that this practice has become of little value. The government can refuse to answer any question on the grounds of so-called public interest. That's what we see in the United States today, in a sense. To this decision, there is no appeal. In addition, when questions are not refused, they are frequently answered in an evasive fashion, which provides no enlightenment whatsoever. And he just goes on to say that that was the regular procedure in answering questions on foreign policy. Then he goes on to give you an impression or a view of how the Constitution, in a sense, is viewed by those who are in government, those of the ruling class. So anything that can really upset their order is deemed a violation of the Constitution. Let's see what else they say here. This process of the weakening and dissolution of the so-called Constitution went so far in the 20th century that by 1932, Sir Austen Chamberlain and Stanley Lord Baldwin were agreed that unconstitutional, in air quotes, is a term applied in politics to the other fellow who does something that you don't like. Simply put, this statement is too sweeping by far. A more accurate estimation of the situation would perhaps be worded in the immediate, worded thus, sorry, air quotes, constitutional, is any action likely to lead to public disorder in the immediate future or likely to affect adversely the government's chances at the polls in any future election. The kind of act which could lead to such a result would be, in the first place, any open act of repression. More important, it would be, in the second place, any open act of unfairness. This is something that I think he quickly has mentioned before about the English, as he's a big Anglophile. This idea of unfairness, or, on its positive side, fair play, is a concept which is very largely Anglo-Saxon and which is largely based on the class structure of England as it existed up to the early 20th century. This class structure was clearly envisioned in the minds of Englishmen and was so completely accepted that it was assumed without any need to be explicitly stated. So Britain was regarded as divided into two groups, the classes and the masses. The classes, he emphasizes, are the ones who had leisure. And remember, Alan would often discuss Plato, raise the point that leisure comes from school. They're the leisure class. They are landed, they have property, and they have, you could say they have a fixed income, so they don't have to work. And then he goes on to tell us a little bit about how their mindset. He mentions that they've got a very distinct accent, a distinct attitude, and that this attitude could be summed up in the statement, the methods are more important than goals. Except that this group regarded the methods and manners in which they acted as goals or closely related to goals. So I wrote my own note here. I just said, you know, this group, they live within their own bubble. They're completely removed from the ruled. They share nothing in common with the people below. They've got a completely different mindset. And you could argue that they've got a different set of genetics. If you look back at the history, they're about as English as an Eskimo, many of these people. So their educational system was based on three great negatives, not easily understood by Americans. The first point is that education must not be vocational. In other words, it's got nothing to do with your job. B, or number two, education is not aimed directly at creating or training the intelligence. And C, education is not aimed at finding the truth, as it were. Rather, it's about moral outlook, getting along, respect for traditions, quality of leadership, and cooperation, and the ability for cooperation in competition, summed up in the English idea of sport and playing the game. And I remember as a child, this was pumped into me. This was because you lived in South Africa and you had, when I was a kid, the Afrikaners were in control. And so there was a distinct you know, you felt very much not Afrikaans if you weren't Afrikaans. Obviously, we were reminded by our parents that we were English, and English people don't throw a temper tantrum if they lose a game of rugby or whatever it is. It's all about participation and the honor and being a good sport. All about being a good sport, you know.
Can I pop in, Darren?
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking about that section a lot yesterday afternoon because it is really, it's alien to the American mind. But I did understand it after some great thinking about it. This class system that they have is about creating an elite Borg, you know, an upper class Borg that are of the same mindset. And when those negatives that they describe in education, if they were pursuing truth or the creation of intelligence or the expansion of intelligence, you're in danger of the individual rising above that school mass, which is sportsman and fair play. In other words, I was always reminded in the corporate world, if I did something and there were a few examples of, I actually wanted people to know that I did it. And my superior told me, my boss said, there's no I in team. And I mouthed back. I said, yes, that's the problem. So the team, you know, team. And it's really a Borg. It's an upper class mass mind that they want to create in their public school, which is, you know, like in America, that's private school. There also is a term that you hear a lot, the English use, that's not cricket. And that's not cricket means that's not fair play. That's not sportsmanlike. You know, so that's not cricket. Well, cricket, again, traditionally has been a sport played by the upper classes. And if you do something that is bad behavior, that's not cricket.
Yeah, is it Fabian Freeway when Nick was covering some of these elite schools that the royalty and high society go to? One of the colleges, I forget which one, but it had almost all of its members were cricketers, ended up being cricketers. So there you go, you know. As quickly went on to say that, just to confirm what you were saying, Melissa, he said, because of the restricted numbers of the upper class in Britain, these attitudes applied chiefly to one another and did not necessarily apply to foreigners or even to the masses. And then it goes a step further. Further, it says they applied to people who, in air quotes, belonged and not to all human beings. Isn't that snooty? Isn't that extremely elitist? They don't even deign that other people should share their values. That is really saying something.
Darren, I forgot to add in that story, in that corporate world, although I was working in the States, my direct superior, my boss, was an English woman based in London of the upper class. And she was very frustrated with me on numerous occasions that I didn't understand her concept of team.
There's a right way, and this is the way it's to be done. And, you know, I can just picture it, Melissa. It quickly then goes on to say that the reason why the ruling class had such a vice grip on all the institutions is that in United Kingdom, everything was based on wealth. The entry to the schools, to the institutions, the army, the navy, and all the rest of it came at a great expense. You know, just a small a fee, a party fee, would cost more than the average income of 80% of the public. The system of wealth that the aristocracy of England had over the rest of the population. They've had an iron grip that's been passed down through, it's remained in their social class for a long, long, long time. And, you know, what do you do if you've got all the institutions in your pocket? You could even, you could lose one of the houses, like the House of Lords, but you've still got the other four. And that was the strength of the Conservatives. In a sense, the Conservatives controlled everything, which will come out later. Let's see, it says here, just quickly said, so the Labour Party did come in, and it came in with support from the unions. It was the party of the unions. The unions were actually taken to task by the Conservatives for it was to be brought into law that the unions were to be financially responsible for the losses and for the damages caused by the laboring classes, either their rioting or their striking or their the damages that they would cause. And so the unions got together and formed their own political party. And as we know from the Fabian Freeway and from the Fabian Socialists, we know it wasn't quite like that. It was highly organized. And I'll try and show later on in this chapter that really, if you think about it, it was the Conservative Party that created the Labour Party. So the Labour Party came about to give the so-called labouring classes a representation in government, because they could collect union dues, and the unions could then pay for the fees that are required to be in government. It quickly just goes on to say that the aristocrats, the loss of this attitude, however, has not been so rapid. That's the attitude of the elite. Has not been so rapid as one might expect, because in the first place, plutocracy, that's wealth, in England has always been closer to aristocracy than in other countries, there being no sharp divisions between the two, with the result that the aristocracy of today is merely the plutocracy of yesterday. If we had to take a closer look at it, Quigley said that the number of real aristocrats in Britain was actually very, very small. The number of nominal or titular aristocrats was large. So title could be bought, but it didn't mean that you belonged. I found that quite interesting. You were useful, but it didn't necessarily mean that you were a somebody. And he says, these new peers have aped the older aristocrats, and this has had the effect of keeping the attitudes, which allow the constitution to function alive. I just made a note here. Wealth and title is closely connected in the United Kingdom as opposed to the United States. Presented even until today. So it's like the wealth system, the aristocrats with their wealth have created a filtering mechanism which runs through all the institutions and particularly starts very early with the educational system. I also made a note on the top of the next page. You see, what's been bothering me in this chapter is that Quigley, earlier on in Tragedy and Hope, was singing in, or waxing lyrical about the virtues of the Anglo system, as opposed to Russia or the East, that the ordinary man could rise to the ranks of the upper classes and be accepted as an equal. And yet, this chapter, he describes exactly the opposite. So I just said, quickly contradicts himself, as he earlier said, Englishmen could climb the social ladder easily and be accepted. He obviously was not including normal people as people. Another little thing that came out in the chapter was that in the United Kingdom, you have public schools. They're called public schools, but they actually are private, and they're very, very elite. So when they talk about the public, they are excluding most of the British population. So what are, if you're not a public, if you're not important enough to be considered as public, what are you then? Just where is the cutoff between being a somebody and a nobody?
He makes a point there that people can get into these elite public schools by money. You know, in other words, their family has achieved success and therefore they can afford to get into the system. They don't come in with that background, that lineage, but they learn. So he's excusing it and showing the way for people outside that birthright system get in is they buy their way in and they tend to adapt. And this is one thing that Alan would always point out. If they pick you and bring you up into their system, it's a given that you will leave everything behind, your old ways. That might be family, your traditions, your background, but definitely your attitudes will have to change. So you can buy your way in, but your attitude must then become like theirs.
I see, Melissa. That makes good sense. I suppose they'll bring in the best, but there's another quote here somewhere further along in the chapter where somebody, his name was Norwood, he said that, an exceptional child from the poor might get through and may get into Oxford, for example, but then went on to say there's not a, I'm paraphrasing, a snowball's chance in hell that he would get into Eton. So it looks like, I suppose, the helpers could, if they were lucky, get into these schools, and then the inner circle, the inner clique of these parties would then keep a watchful eye over them, and as you say, bring them in.
Darren, could I drop in a bit of information?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, you were just talking there about Eton. I recall seeing an image there a while ago, taken at Eton. And in the photograph was a group of people, among which was Tony Blair and Boris Johnson, the two of them. And it was one of these photographs. They were all dressed in tuxedos, and they all were posed with attitude, if you understand. So there you go, Blair and Johnson in the one photograph taken in Eton.
Yes, in actual fact, Alan would mention H.G. Wells was very much the same. He came from a sort of humble background. Also, Eric Blair, the writer, they were invited in, and they very quickly formed a fear and a disliking for where they had just been or come from. Quickly mentions with the Labour Party, when the Labour Party really got moving, it showed that within the Labour Party, I'm reading again, the majority of whose members have had no opportunity to acquire the attitude necessary to allow the proper functioning of the constitutional system. The problem has been alleviated to a considerable extent by the fact that the members of that party who are of working class origin, remember that the Labour Party was already got going by very elitist Fabians. It was for the, air quotes, the workers, but it was started up and run by elitists. So the people who came into the Labour Party who weren't of this class, it says here, the problem has been alleviated by the fact that the members of that party who are of working class origin have given very wide influence to the small group of party members who were of the upper class origin. The working class members of the Labour Party have proved susceptible to what is called the aristocratic embrace. And that's once again, it's appealing to the ego. You know, you've been invited in and now you're meeting these people and you want to fit in and you want to impress. That is, they have shown a deference to the points of view and above all to the manners and position of the upper classes and have done so to a degree which would be impossible to find in any country where class lines were not so rigidly drawn as in England. the working class members of the Labour Party, when they entered Parliament, did not reject the old upper class methods of action, but on the contrary sought to win upper class approval and to retain lower class support by demonstrating that they could run the government as well as the upper class, as well as the upper class had always done. Thus, the business class leaders of the Conservative Party and the working class leaders of the Labour Party both consciously sought to imitate the older aristocratic attitude. The chief element in the old attitude, which both the new Conservatives as they advanced and the Labour failed to grasp, was the one which we have attempted to describe as emphasis on methods rather than goals. As Labour came into play, they started to become a lot more vociferous in their politicking. They didn't want to follow these genteel elitist, the methods are the goals type thing. Slowly, the parties started competing with each other more, and there started to become a widening drift between the Conservatives and the Labour Party. As quickly goes on to say, they became more willing to cut corners. The custom of the Constitution thus rests only on public opinion as a sanction, and any British government can do what it wishes so long as it does not enrage public opinion. This sanction is not nearly so effective as might appear at first glance because of the difficulty with which public opinion in England has in obtaining information, and also because public opinion in England can express itself only through the ballot, and the people cannot get an election unless the government wishes to give one. Yeah, so if people in the United States look back at merry old England, well, it's not so merry. The people have completely different system of government. And, well, I suppose life in the UK hasn't always been roses, but the people in the UK haven't really had, ordinary people have had no rights at all, not even in writ, nothing written down. And that must be quite a shock to the average American hearing that. Let's see what I have to underline here. The Commons and Cabinet are generally controlled by the same party. This group can do what it wishes with the minimum publicity or public protest, only if the other three parts of the government cooperate. These three parts are the monarchy, the House of Lords, and the civil service. Since all three of these have been traditionally conservative, a conservative government could generally count on their cooperation. So he runs through this, and just to reinforce the idea that the conservatives, the plutocrats and the aristocrats, are essentially all the same people. And before the Labour Party came into existence, you had the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. I think it was the Liberal Party that were more the industrialists. And the Conservative Party, well, they were known as the Unionists, which is quite odd, because the Labour Party came in to oppose the Conservatives later on as the Trade Union Party. What's interesting is that as the Labour Party came and started getting traction, the Liberal Party started to lose ground. But the Conservatives and the Liberals were one and the same social group. They would be related to each other. They would be, they'd belong to all the same social clubs, high society. They would quite famously have a banquet at each other's mansion, and then the very next day they would be ripping each other to shreds in Parliament. So when the Labour Party started to take shape, a lot of the Liberals just migrated towards the Conservative Party. But the Conservative Party was chock full of the aristocracy, and all the other chambers, the Commons, the Lords, the Cabinet, they were all the plutocrats, the aristocracy, the landed gentry, they would occupy all the divisions of government. So even if a Labour or Liberal government came into full power, it was really the Conservatives could control or block any particular bill of law which the opposition tried to pass. In a sense, the Conservative Party still ruled, even though they weren't in government at the time.
Can I interject something here? I just now looked up unionism. So it's different. It says in the United Kingdom, unionism is a political stance favoring the continued unity of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland as one sovereign state, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Ah, so, thanks, Melissa.
Yeah.
Did you also remember there was something going around? Somebody brought to the attention of the British public somewhere, I don't know whether it's true or false, that when England and Scotland signed that, what was it called, the Union, that apparently the document was not actually signed. I don't know if anyone has heard of that. But
Alan has mentioned that a few times, and actually he said, I won't be able to pull it up out of either my mind or the internet, but he said that the unsigned document is in some art, you know, museum. In other words, it's publicly available to see that it was never signed or ratified.
Which would give the ruling aristocracy of England, that they cheated out the poor Scots. So they've occupied their territory and haven't actually given them a ratified treaty or union.
Well, that's what the true Scotsman believes.
it explains quite a lot. I mean, some of the other history that I've read in the past is that, you know, when the Normans came into England, and then the Anglo-Normans then went into Scotland, what they found is that when they went into Scotland, there was already an Anglo-Saxon elite. As part of the, they were sort of running Scotland, or at least the lowland Scots, and they shook hands very, very quickly and made deals with the Anglo-Normans quite quickly and gave each other title. They gave the Normans title in Scotland quite quickly, and the poor old ordinary Scot, and particularly the Highland Scots, were completely cheated. It's almost as if they didn't count. So there's a hell of a lot of skullduggery that's always occurred, you know. So there's no separation of powers. The cabinet is the government and is expected to govern not only within the law, but if necessary, without law or even against the law. There you go. There is no limit on retroactive legislation, and no cabinet or parliament can bind its successors. In other words, if you sum it all up, the ruling elite control the house, all its chambers, and really can do what they want. And when there are new faces and new names, they can also do what they want. They don't have to follow on with what their predecessors agreed to.
Darren, could I just chip something in here? That sounds a lot to me like do as thou wilt.
Very much so, Frank. The ruling elite of the UK have sort of, I'm guessing, have shown everyone else who wants to be in control of the world. They've got a system which I imagine that others envy and other parts of the world have tried to copy and haven't quite got it right. And the people have pushed back. And so slowly but surely, the English system that Cecil Rhodes spoke about is being implemented everywhere around the world. And the reason why we don't pick it up is that it's like a chameleon, and it's secrecy. So the English or the British model is being implemented worldwide. It looks different wherever you go, but it's one and the same system behind the scenes. Because as quickly mentioned with the cabinet, they don't have to seek anyone's approval. He gave a couple of examples where the cabinet just went and used the budget without informing any other division of government. So essentially they can do what they want. They are the boss. Britain is supposed to be a multicameral system in which the cabinet is the second chamber, the Commons the third, and the Lords the fourth. Of these three, the Conservatives always have control of the Lords, and the same party generally has control of the other two. Legislation originates in the meetings of the inner clique, there you go, circles within circles, of the party, acting as a first chamber. If accepted by the cabinet, it passes the Commons almost automatically. The Commons, rather than a legislative body, is the public forum, okay, in which the party announces the decisions it has made in secret party and cabinet meetings. So, you know, the poor old British people are—they're subjects, really, as it to the establishment, to the Queen. Imagine being a subject. I certainly don't see myself as a subject to anyone. But many people in the UK, I've heard them all the time saying, her or his majesty's subjects. And they love, well, half the UK loves the aristocracy or the royalty. So the situation is sometimes called cabinet dictatorship. It could more accurately be called party dictatorship. Both the cabinet and the commons are controlled by the party, or more accurately, by the inner clique of the party. The inner clique of the Conservative Party sometimes met at the Carlton Club, and the inner clique of the Labour Party, they met in a trade union conclave, transport house. And what's that saying? I made a little note here. I said, don't forget about Freemasonry in the background. It's never mentioned, but Freemasonry is what enables all of this to happen. So these inner cliques will meet at these various houses, but they're all Freemasons. So that's your other layer. So behind the scenes, when they're meeting in private clubs, they are setting their policy, which then goes back to the inner clique, and then to the rest of the party. So you see how it works. The implication here that the cabinet controls the commons, that commons will never overthrow the cabinet, and that it will not reject legislation acceptable to the cabinet, is based on the assumption that the party has a majority in commons. Yeah, they got their people in everywhere. In Britain, the restrictions were almost all based on one criterion, possession of wealth. And he goes on to say that this situation, the public have just swallowed it. They just accept it. That means that the back of the British people, the psychological backs of the British people were broken a long time ago. That's why they call them the establishment. They're so established that people don't even, they might bicker a bit at the pubs, but they're broken. It's very interesting.
Hey, Darren, I got an idea.
Hi.
Hey, just hearing you talk about unionism and Melissa's definition of unionism that she looked up, it just reminded me when the South voted to leave the Union in the United States, and there was a civil war, and then after the Civil War, and the Union was held together because the vote was held and the South voted to leave, Marx congratulated Lincoln on keeping the Union together. And that's just something, this thought or idea just kept popping into my head hearing you talk about all the representation of wealth and aristocracy.
Too, Darren, you made a good point there about the undercurrent of Freemasonry that runs underneath and throughout all of this. And last week when I was illustrating the Redux that went up on Sunday, And there was the revolutionary song that had been sung at the Olympics, and it had been inspired by Benjamin Franklin. And I was thinking, I put up the visuals, I didn't say anything at the time, but, you know, he was Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris, a huge Freemason. And earlier when you started talking about the Constitution of the United States, and I was thinking about, you know, the Bill of Rights are the amendments to the Constitution. And who is behind the, you know, Bill of Rights is a man by the name of George Mason. Now, I mean, that's just his name. It doesn't mean anything. I don't know what his affiliations are, but it said that his great-grandfather was a cavalier. And the cavalier was the term used by the Roundheads as a term of abuse for the wealthier royalist supporters of Charles I and his son Charles II. So, we have to remember here in the States that we are a great experiment, and our founding fathers, many of them were Freemasons, and many of them were the sons and grandsons of very wealthy Englishmen.
Yeah. I want to put something to the floor. At the very beginning of the chapter, he quickly talks about a revolution. That was very profound. And as I was going through the chapter, I was jumping a little bit back and forth over whether this revolution was really benefiting the average British citizen or not. And I just wanted to ask what your thoughts are about this revolution, because when you go through the whole chapter, he doesn't really, at least I didn't see it, he didn't offer a conclusion like,
I noticed that too, Darren. Yeah. He didn't define what the outcome was or, you know, who it was good for. And I had the same thought that, you know, since you're asking the group, my reaction is no, it was not good for the people. What it did is it gives what we see in the years that he's covering there is it is giving the average English, British citizen, the idea that he's participating, that he's able to participate in the system. And you've got some of the appearances of democracy, but I don't see that in practice at all. I was actually kind of shocked by the time I got to the end of the chapter at how, at what a facade English political system is, the British political system is.
I think that is
the... Darren, perhaps, yeah. And Alyssa, yeah. Pardon me, perhaps Quigley had in his mind a revolution for sure, but it was probably, it may have been on the basis of that work of Tragedy and Hope that he was completing, and he was thinking in terms of the revolution that was going to bring. Maybe that's what it was. In other words, he didn't quite finish his thoughts because of that.
Frank, my feeling when I was reading the chapter was that, to me, the revolution was, it was an anti-revolution, was the revolution, if that makes sense. In other words, the way that the British people had so little say in anything could have been absolutely disastrous had the people cottoned on to just how little say they had. And then I think Quigley did give it away where he said the Liberal and the Labour Party, I think the Labour Party was actually created by the elite, because Quigley kind of hides it. He says that it started with the trade unions and it gave the labouring working classes as a voice in government, but that's not what you read when you study the Fabians. The Fabians had a very, very specific purpose for creating the Labour Party, and the Labour Party was created by elitists for the elitists. But you, in other words, they had to give the people a place to vent in, and give them the illusion that they were having more of a say. So the Conservative Party, because they controlled everything, they controlled all those chambers, it only makes sense that the Masonic system needed to bring in this, you know, it's the next step that leads towards the technocratic system. They needed to create the Labour Party. You kind of know this because look at what the Labour Party is today. As of Keir Starmer, it was always a party by the establishment for the masses to prevent a real revolution. So they gave the people, in a sense, a soft, passive revolution, in a sense. Leading up to World War II, they really started taking away a lot of the rights that the working class had managed to get in the couple of decades before World War II, as the chapter goes on. Plutocracy restricted democracy in Britain to a notable but decreasing degree in the period before 1945. This was more evident in social or economic life than political life. And once again, that's because of wealth, and the poor were just blocked out of everything. And they just had to dance to the tune of the businessmen, and the businessmen, the leading industrialists, the owners of everything, were the Conservative Party. There was no hypocrisy in that, and the average British citizen just accepted that. So big business and big politics was in the hands of the same people. And what do we see with the Roman Senate? What do we see with the American Senate is that fasci, the axe, which is strapped to all those sticks. I mean, what we're looking at here with the British system is very much that situation. It's pure fascism. Quigley just goes on to describe the upper classes they had the right to vote twice, once for their business dealings and once politically. They were able to restrict any kind of real opposition to themselves by various methods of, mostly by pricing everyone else out of the market, so to speak. He gives a few examples of the membership fees that had to be paid for members of parliament to be in the party. Once you were in the party, you would have to attend various social clubs, which all had barrier to entrance fees. As a result, I'm reading now, of these monetary barriers, the overwhelming mass of Englishmen could not participate actively in politics unless they could find an outside source of funds. By finding this source in labor unions in the period after 1890, they created a new political party organized on a class basis and forced the merger of the two existing parties into a single group, also organized on a class base. And that is, they forced the liberals to merge with the conservatives. But, you know, look at the language that Quigley uses here. He makes it look like the Labour Party was almost like a natural set of circumstances. He fails to bring in the Fabians and to discuss the people that were behind the installation of this party. So let's see. Until 1915, the two parties represented the same social class, the small group known as society or the public. In fact, both parties, conservatives and liberals, were controlled from at least 1866 by the same small clique. This clique consisted of no more than half a dozen chief families, their relatives and allies, reinforced by an occasional recruit from outside. These recruits were generally obtained from the select educational system of, once again, society, being found in Balliol, how do you pronounce that? Balliol, or New College at Oxford, or at Trinity College, Cambridge, where they first attracted attention either by scholarship or in the debates of the Oxford or Cambridge Union. Having attracted attention in this fashion, the new recruits were given opportunities to prove their value to the inner clique of each party and generally ended by marrying into one of the families which dominated. And when you when you marry, you are bound. You are bound. Just wanted to see here. He goes on to talk about how Lord Salisbury basically was the government. He and his family, his nephews, his protégés. Lord Salisbury, he served 3 terms, and he was very well known at the time for his nepotism, which wasn't called nepotism back then, I'm sure. It was quite normal. Something that I found, which is quite amusing, is that Lord Salisbury, his name was Robert. I think in the Wikipedia article it brought out that because he had so many of his family in government, the term Bob's your uncle. You know the term Bob's your uncle comes from there. Robert is Bob. And so Bob's your
uncle. Darren, thank you so much. I've always wanted to know that.
Yeah, it means that, you're going to be fine because Bob's your uncle. I just found that out today, and it makes so much sense.
He can be your aunt today too, you know.
That's true, Frank. And I'd like to get behind, where does Uncle Sam come from again? I'm sure I've read it about it before, but I can't remember anything. But there's a good reason for the term Uncle Sam. Can anyone remember what it is?
I'm just going to say Uncle Sam reminds me of Big Brother.
Yeah.
He does. Yeah, there is a little bit of that. But the Uncle Sam that we know, that familiar one that's on the website, that one was a World War I recruiting poster. And I don't think that they've ever pinpointed who it comes from. I think it's legendary, and there are a couple of different ideas of who Sam was.
I think if you had to wager, just off the cuff, that it had a Masonic meaning, then you'd probably be right. Then see here. So really quickly then goes on to say here, the chief change from 1900 to 1960 was to be found in the fact that in 1900, the two parties represented a small and exclusive social class, remote from the voters' experience. See there? Remote from the voters' experience. While in 1960... the two parties represented two antithetical social classes, which were both remote from the average voter. And that became wider and wider because the one party was all about the needs of the laboring classes, and the conservatives was all about the interests of the elite, and the poor old man in the middle class, were completely left out of the picture. They didn't have any political representation. Both parties, really, the people in the middle were alienated, and some of them chose to vote for a party to rather, not because they wanted to vote for the party, but was to try and block the negative effect of the opposing party. It's the lesser of the two evils, because both parties were exploiting the middle class. The poor old middle class were left with no one to represent them in public. So he goes on and on. Once having accepted the fact that politicians are the direct representatives of economic interests, there would be little point in objecting when politicians act in accordance with their economic interests. He was just describing how the people really were resigned to the fate of the situation.
Darren, I heard politicians recently being referred to as the fleas in the fur of the dog of war.
That's excellent, Frank. That's just what it is. Parasites. He goes on to describe Lord Salisbury, the relationship of Lord Salisbury of the Conservative Party with Arthur James Balfour, which we've learned a lot about from the Fabians, with regards to Palestine. The cabinet was packed with his relatives and close associates of the Cecil family. I've got a book here called The Cecils, which I've read, but it's much like reading Tragedy and Hope. There's so much in it that you can't really, you'd have to like go and open the book up and reference it again. that Hatfield House was really, it was just another palace for the royal family and the who's who in English society. It's fascinating. I'm actually even more fascinated by the fact that the public, the general public through time of just about every society on earth, very, very seldom ever has a go at these people. I'm just looking at corrupt old South Africa and thinking, there's 60 million people. These politicians are so openly corrupt. Surely just one angry person will take a pot shot at them. And it never happens. It's very, very, that fascinates me on a fundamental level. So he just gives examples of the various relatives of Lord Salisbury, Gerald Balfour, the brother of Arthur, Salisbury's son, Viscount Cranbourne, and the very high positions they held, Lord Selborne, Walter Long, it's just George Curzon, all these people that he's mentioned earlier in the book. And he just points out how they are related to each other through friendship, family, brother-in-laws.
When I was reading through this, there were a couple of names that I wanted to see what the connections were. And the first was Swinton, and the second was Snowden. And I wondered if, you know, there was a connection there between Edward Snowden, the American. But the spelling of the name is different. The spelling doesn't always mean something, but I couldn't find a connection there. But with Swinton, what was on my mind was the British actress Tilda Swinton. And as it turns out, she probably is related. I didn't have time to do the genealogy all the way back, but she probably is related to the Swinton in this chapter. And interestingly, her grandmother, I think it was, or it might have been her mother, had the name Balfour in her full name. And I've noticed that before with either sports people in the UK or television presenters or actors, is that so often, you know, they're presented, they're even given a kind of common person accent. But when you do the homework on them, you find that they come from the aristocracy, the ruling class.
Very much so, Melissa. The Anglo-American establishment name drops so much. And when you start looking into all of those names and you follow the family tree, as far as you can go, you start encountering a lot of actors and actresses and people in business. It's very, very interesting how they all are part of such a big clique. Yet, it seems very big, actually. But when you start quantifying it and you start counting, it's thousands. But really, it's in comparison to the rest of us, that they're a very tiny group. I just want to read something here. The Liberal Party was not so closely controlled as was the Conservative Party, but its chief leaders were on intimate relations of friendship and cooperation with the Cecil crowd, the Conservatives. This was especially true of Lord Rosebery, who was Prime Minister in 1894-95, and H.H. Asquith, who was Prime Minister in 1905-1915. Asquith married Margot Tennant, sister-in-law of Alfred Lyttelton, in 1894, and had Balfour as his chief witness at the ceremony. Lyttelton was the nephew of Gladstone, as Balfour was the nephew of Salisbury. In later years, Balfour was the closest friend of the Asquiths, even when they were leaders of two opposing parties. And then it says, Balfour frequently joked of the fact that he had dinner with champagne at Asquith's house before going to the House of Commons to attack his host's policies. On Thursday evenings, when Asquith dined at his club, Balfour had dinner with Mrs. Asquith, and the Prime Minister would stop by to pick her up on his way home. It was on an evening of this kind that Balfour and Mrs. Asquith agreed to persuade Asquith to write his memoirs. Asquith had been almost as friendly with another powerful leader of the Conservative Party, Lord Milner. This ends on a funny note. These two ate their meals together, for 4 years, at the scholarship table in Balliol. in the 1870s and had supper together on Sunday evenings in the 1880s. Mrs. Asquith had a romantic interlude with Milner in Egypt in 1892, when she was still Margot Tennant, and later claimed that she got him his appointment as chairman of the board of Inland Revenue by writing to Balfour from Egypt to ask for this favor. I put a smiley face here for the next sentence. In 1908, according to W.T. Stead, Mrs. Asquith had three portraits over her bed, those of Rosebery, Balfour, and Milner. I don't know if you've that's very, very interesting. And remember, Darren,
we get the picture.
Remember W.T. Stead, remember in the beginning of the book, he was one of the three founders of the original society that got off the ground with Milner and Rhodes. And W.T. Stead was, he's this mysterious person. He was just a journalist, you know. But probably that Boris Johnson is a journalist. They come from very elite families.
I was just going to say that those portraits over her bed, that gives a whole new definition to unionism.
Yeah, very much. Quickly has got a sense of humor. And I wrote on a note here at the bottom, I said, Fabians enter the scene. So the Labour Party arose because of the discovery by the masses of the people that their vote did not avail them much, so long as the only choice of candidates was, as Bagehot put it, which of two rich people will you choose? And then I made a note there, the Fabians enter the scene. The issue came to a head because of a judicial decision in the Taff Vale case of 1901. The courts decided that labor unions were responsible for damages resulting from their economic actions. To overcome this decision, which could have crippled the unions by making them financially responsible for the damages arising from strikes, the working classes turned to political action by setting up their own candidates in their own party. And what he's saying there is a bit of a white lie. They didn't set up anything. It was set up. The people had to be convinced of the whole backdrop of Marxist and the talk with related to the Communist Internationals. There's a whole background scene to it all. It didn't just happen by people who were frustrated they couldn't get a vote. The Labour Party is, in theory, somewhat more democratic than the Conservatives, since its annual party conference is the final authority on policies and candidates. But, here's the kicker, since unions provide the bulk of the members and the party funds, the unions dominate the party. Remember earlier on in Tragedy and Hope how he spoke about, I forget how it was worded, but the unions themselves were actually set up and arranged by the industrialists. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah, it's definitely, you see how the people are played for a sucker every step of the way. So quickly is he's given it away. People that read at this level, I imagine he would take it for granted that they remembered what he said earlier in the book, I assume. But I think a lot of people who grab this book for the very first time, who don't understand how things are working, they won't pick that up. They'll tend to follow with the book and forget what he mentioned earlier. So the unions dominate the party, meaning that the individual still had no say, had no real vote on real issues. The unions could be controlled, the same aristocracy that went to meet at their social clubs, and then they could plan what they wanted to do with the Labour Party, and then just act it out. It goes on and on. The poor old Labour Party didn't have much money, blah, blah, blah. Since the two chief parties in England do not represent the ordinary Englishman, but instead represent the entrenched economic interests directly, there is relatively little lobbying or attempting to influence legislators by political or economic pressure. This is quite different from the United States, where lobbyists sometimes seem to be the only objects on a congressman's horizon. In England, where the economic interests are directly represented in Parliament, lobbying comes chiefly from groups influenced by non-economic issues like divorce, women's suffrage, anti-vivisection, and so on. That's just reinforcing the idea that poor old British are absolutely ruled over. Then I highlighted a quote here by Sir Cyril Norwood, headmaster at Harrow School, where he said that a boy from a poor home may get to Oxford, but he's got no chance to enter Eton. Let's see what else here. He talks about the civil service. Just give an example that the civil service in Britain was uniform in all the regular departments of the government and was divided into three levels. From the bottom up, these were known as clerical, executive, and administrative. The administrative was the most important level, was reserved to the well-to-do classes. Persons to be found in the principal positions of the civil service in 1850, 1900, or 1930 did not differ markedly in type. Once again, it's the upper classes that had all the say. It was interestingly, the clerical services, the bishops, the church, the leaders of the church were part of the elite. They went to the same schools, the highest level of British society, of the clerical side. They are all members of the aristocracy. They're stinking rich. Oh, sorry, when I was looking up Lord Salisbury and Hatfield House, one of the archbishops of the time, 300 years or so ago, actually constructed a palace, an old palace that is still, a part of it is still on the Hatfield House property. But it goes to show you that even the church, which people often forget is a state apparatus, people often think it's free of that, but it's not. It's controlled by the state. It's an arm of the state. He just goes on to show that the ordinary British subject couldn't even get into the priesthood at that level without being part of the aristocracy. Accordingly, the ordinary Englishman... he goes on to talk about the legal system, the terms for getting into to become an advocate or a judge, the training, the expense. It was beyond, far, far beyond the ability of an ordinary person to get into the legal system. And as a result, members of the bar have been until very recently almost entirely from the well-to-do classes, since judges are appointed exclusively from barristers with from 7 to 15 years of experience. The judicial system has also been monopolized by the upper classes. With a system of legal administration and justice such as this, the process of obtaining justice has been complex, slow, and above all, expensive. As a result, only the fairly well-to-do can defend their rights in a civil suit. And if the less well-to-do go to court at all, they find themselves in an atmosphere completely dominated by members of the upper classes. Accordingly, the ordinary Englishmen, over 90% of the total, avoid all litigation, even when he has right on his side. As a result of the conditions just described, the political history of Britain in the 20th century has been a long struggle for equality. This struggle has appeared in various forms as an effort to extend educational opportunities, as an effort to extend health and economic security to the lower classes, as an effort to open the upper ranks of the civil services and the defense forces, as well as the House of Commons itself, to those classes which lacked the advantages of leisure and training provided by wealth. In this struggle for equality, the goal has been sought by leveling the upper classes as well as by leveling the lower classes up. The privileges of the former have been curtailed, especially by taxation and more impersonal methods of recruitment to office, at the same time that the opportunities of the latter have been extended by widening education advantages and by the practice of granting a living payment for services rendered. In this struggle, revolutionary changes have been made by the Liberal and Conservative parties, as well as by the Labour Party, each hoping to be rewarded by the gratitude of the masses. So there's your revolution. And he goes on to give a few sort of examples, but it's not really much of a revolution, if you think about it. Since 1924, the two major parties have, as already mentioned, come to represent two opposing vested economic interests, the interests of entrenched wealth and of entrenched unionism. This has resulted in making the positions of the two parties considerably more antithetical than they were in the period before 1915, when both major parties represented the same segment of society. Moreover, since 1923, as the alienation of the two parties on the political scene had become steadily wider, there has risen a tendency for each to take on the form of an exploiting group in regard to the great middle class. I'll sort of try and cut it short now. He goes on to talk about the political history to 1939, and he talks about how the Conservatives, you know, had 10 years. Then the Liberals came in, and then the Labour Party came in, and how they went back and forth trying to dominate. But the conclusion, the result was, I'll read again, to create a new society of privilege. So the result was a new society of privilege, which from some points of view looked like an inversion of the society of privilege of 1900. The new privileged were the trade union elite of the working classes, not really of the working classes, the older privileged of the upper classes, while the exploited were the middle class of white collar and professional workers who did not have the unionized strength of the one or the invested wealth of the other. So then he gives the political history, and he shows how the Conservatives and the Liberals and the Labour went about competing with one another. But long story short is that they agreed upon at the end of the day to cooperate. So the Conservatives and Labour pre-World War II decided not to go rioting and striking and damaging things. They ended up agreeing to rather exploit to their mutual benefit the consumers of Britain. And ain't that wonderful? Ugh. So I think that sort of sums it up mostly. Oh, here, I made a note here. For as long as union political activities were illegal, the Labourite members of the Commons had to support Asquith in order to avoid a general election they could no longer finance. In order to permit the existing Labour members to live without union funds, here we are, the Asquith government in 1911 established payment for members of Parliament for the first time. And then I made a note, and I said, the birth of the career politician. I don't know if you agree with me there, but it looked like you could earn a salary just for being in the government.
I was thinking about American politics specifically, and we don't have time to get into this, but I was thinking that of all of the changes that have occurred in the American political system since he wrote that, in not necessarily changes on the books, but in practice. And I don't follow politics closely at all, and everybody knows that. But I do have people around me that are, you know, I mean, they believe that they're into it. And that one pointed out to me recently that we have a very organized, particularly within the Democratic Party, it's a very unified system. It is no longer in any way could be considered localized. It's a very centralized party, and everyone does what the party wants them to do. what I see is that our so-called elected officials go in as, you know, a businessman or whatever their background is, and they leave Congress or the Senate very wealthy. And this is generally a form of insider trading, kickbacks. I mean, there have been, there's a congresswoman, I don't remember her name right now, Cynthia somebody, but she's gone on record as saying, you know, talking about the bribe system. You just, you know, a little envelope arrives at the door. You know which way you're supposed to vote. You know, if you want to keep the money, that's the way you vote.
I think there's a word for that, Melissa. It's called corruption.
I had a thought, and it's just in the back of my mind. It's a bit of a whimsical one, but when I think about how, you know, the founding fathers of America went into the lodge and they closed all the windows, and they came out with a constitution, and Franklin famously said, you know, you've got a constitutional republic if you can keep it. Then I compare the UK and what we've covered here. And if you think about the US system from that original formation of the Constitution and how it's become a democracy where you have lobbying groups, the next step from what we see in the American system, I wouldn't be surprised if what we have seen in the United States actually occurred, just as a silly theory, maybe it occurred in the UK 1,000 years ago and it resulted in what we see with the UK now. I'm just entertaining it as a sort of, a little possibility because, you know, those Masons, you know, the archives of knowledge with regard to these groups of what's been tried before and what has been done before and what leads to what. It makes me wonder what Franklin meant when he said, if you can keep it, because I think there is a bit of a possibility that a constitutional republic slowly becomes corrupted to where you have vested interests and eventually an aristocracy settles in and you have a royalty. And I'm just curious if at some point in time, England or other countries in Europe might have had what America has now. It's just a thought. And I think that's where I'm going to leave it. I think that sort of sums up chapter 10 more or less.
Very well done, Darren. Thank you very much. A huge package of information there, both entertaining and highly educational. God bless.
So next, yes, thank you, Darren. You did a great job, and this has been good to do this. I appreciate everyone who, I wish more people would have popped up. I see there's lots of listeners, but not many talkers today, but that's okay. So this month's reading in August, again, is Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, and Frank has graciously said that he will lead out and that he'll be prepared to do that sometime. I think the dates he gave were between the 27th and the 31st. So we need to decide when we'll do the group chat on that. And then whenever that is, we'll have a little video of the talk that'll go up a few days afterwards. So that is it, I think.
I'd just like to say thanks to all that have been speaking, and it's every time I listen to you, it's an education. Thanks so much.